The weekly headlines. Rising voices in Real World Radio. Welcome to Rising Voices. Today is Friday the 9th of April and it's our second show of the year, our 29th edition. Welcome, Mercedes. How are you?
Hi, welcome.
Well, we forgot to mention in our last show that this year the show is going to be on Fridays at 12 p.m. in Uruguay time. That's GMT minus 3, so you should check your clocks. And we're going to read the main headlines of the week. With Manshi Asher, environmental and social activist from India.
Another Brazilian leader murdered, crimes still unpunished.
New electoral victory for MAS in Bolivia.
30 brigade members from Brazil are in a solidarity mission in Haiti.
Climate conference in Cochabamba to open up space for the solutions of peoples. So we have an interview this week with Manshi Asher. She's an environmental and social activist and researcher. From India, she works on livelihood and environmental rights, and she also works with other activists on environmental damage and displacement of people, for instance, by displacement by the mining and cement industries. And we talked about different things. About first of all, we talked about this very important bill that was passed in India last month. It is a bill that gives a quota for women in parliament.
Yes, this bill provides 33% of the seats that should be occupied by women, and currently that percentage is approximately 10%. So it's a huge change for the Indian parliament.
Yeah, so Manshi explains a little bit about this and what the significance it has for India. We're going to listen to what she was telling us.
And this bill was one step towards, like, an affirmative action towards ensuring participation of women in the political process. And reservation is often new for India because we've had similar reservation along caste lines. So women have, since 1995, have had reservations, 33% reservations in these local village councils, which are the lowest unit of political decision-making, where, you know, every village selects their head, and there's a body, a committee, which makes decisions, like the lands for the village, allocates budgets, you know. So basically, the reservation for women at the level of the village council, as somebody who has, you know, been working in this field for the last about 12 years, and associated with the women's, you know, organizations been a part of, seen how, you know, work in rural areas, seen how these councils function, I feel that, yes, there have been lots of problems with the implementation. The most major being that, you know, the husband or the brothers or the fathers of the women continue to dominate the women who get, who have a quota and get selected in a particular, get elected in a particular village. They're, you know, the patriarchal figure in that family is the one who's actually making decisions. So it's like a puppet, you know, position type of thing. But what my experience has been and what the experience in general has been is that it has brought out a lot of women into the political and public decision-making space at the village level. And we've seen drastic changes in the way these village councils are run because women are less prone to corruption. They are more proactive. They are more proactive on women's issues in the village. And as a result, there has been a great deal of empowerment because of this reservation policy. And a lot of women across the country have, you know, kind of researched this. A lot of women's groups have researched this, have, you know, been working towards strengthening, you know, of this particular reservation policy and its implementation, and women who stood for these elections on the quota seats, they've had to face repression and they've had to face a character assassination. They've been, you know, maligned, raped, all kinds of things. But it's brought the struggle out in the open, I mean, for that political space. And that has been the positive part, you know, and it has brought a lot of women to the forefront. It has opened up doors for participation of women. And based on this positive experience of the last 15 years, you know, there is now like a trust towards this bill being passed. Where similar reservation is, it's not just at the local level, at the, you know, grassroots panchayat or what do you call it, the village level, but it goes through the system right till the top at the central level or the national level.
So that was Manshi telling us about this new bill and what it implies. Well, she was saying there's still a lot of discrimination against women and, well, some, as she was saying, husbands who are taking advantage of these positions that women are having now in the villages. But at the same time, she's saying that women are more active and are participating more in the decision-making process in the villages that are, well, she mentioned one of these there are councils that they call panchayas or something like that, that they are like the local centers of power, and that's where women have more influence. And, well, then we went on talking, and she explained a little bit about also the economic situation in India and the farmer situation, because, well, as many of you may have heard, India and China are being promoted as the big economies, growing economies, and an example for the developing nations. But what is really happening with the economic situation, who is benefiting and who is bearing the brunt of this model that is being applied in India? So we'll listen to what she told us.
You do a lot of work that has to do with, of course, environmental justice and mining and cement projects and dams. And you know that in Latin America we have the same problems, specifically, well, we have a huge movement that's the people, the dam-affected people, and we have problems with dams in Brazil, we have problems with cement companies in Guatemala, that people are being killed. So I would like you to tell me a little bit about what are these conflicts like in India, and like, what is the current situation? Are people resisting? And what is the government's answer also to these problems?
In the last 20 years, since 1990s, being the, you know, the Congress and the right-wing BJP have been very clear. I mean, none of them have gone back on this as far as opening up of the economy goes, as far as privatization, pushing for you know, opening up the mining sector, opening up privatizing and opening up other sectors of the economy. So obviously that has meant that the onslaught for extraction of resources is more, and that has meant a direct conflict with people who are dependent on the resources, which basically are land, water, and forest. I mean, these are the three main, you know, resources which are involved in setting up of these projects. So, we've had a series of policies that facilitate, easier kind of, acquisition of land and for industrialization as well as for these large projects. And we've had dilution of environmental laws in the last, especially in the last 6 years to facilitate and make it easy. I mean, make the regulatory framework more flexible kind of thing so that the industries get their clearances fast, etc. So this has obviously brought, it has sharpened the conflict, which was there before also. There has been, India has seen millions of people displaced from rural areas, tribals, indigenous communities being thrown off their land. It's very polarized at this point. It's becoming more and more difficult to fight the state. The middle class in the last 20 years in India, which is very strong in urban areas, has gained a lot from this economic reforms process. It's all actually about the fight for resources. That's more or less how polarized.
Okay, so she was actually telling us about what the conflicts are right now in India regarding mining and cement industries, because, that's more or less the work that she's doing there, working with the communities who are resisting. And, she was mentioning a certain dilemma that happens there, that the middle class benefits from this model that implies privatization and giving land to corporations, to private corporations. And, of course, as a result of that, communities are being displaced. So, she was explaining more or less that conflict, and it's more or less what happens here as well in Latin America. So in the next question was about this economic model and also how it is affecting the farming industry and other sectors.
There are statistics about farmers committing suicide in India. There's like high rates of that. And so perhaps you can elaborate a little bit, because people get those stories here, but they don't really understand what is going on.
The huge focus in the last 20 years has been on the service sector. So we have like three sectors in the economy. We have the service, the manufacturing, and the primary sector. And agriculture falls in the primary sector. And what the government has done is it has started subsidizing large corporate houses. It's pumping in the resources and the facilities and the, it's opening up the economy for the companies to invest in these two sectors, manufacturing and service, whereas the government financing of agriculture and primary industry has been very poor. In fact, policies have kind of been such, whether they are trade-related policies or especially our stands on the WTO, opening up, the trade would be, allowing the import of food grains and allowing, for instance, GM, BT kind of cotton, and allowing more kind of multinational companies to come into the agriculture sector, at the same time making, loans for farmers more expensive. At the same time, the market for agriculture produce has been weakened because, farmers don't get the price they're supposed to. So it's created, and they're grabbed off their land because of the kind of agricultural practices that were introduced in the 70s, which is basically the Green Revolution period, where it was about intensive agriculture with lots of chemicals and, pump out the water from the ground and irrigate the lands and, use chemical fertilizers, hybridization of seeds. So there's a whole process that has happened which has weakened the agricultural system and completely opened up the farmers to risks from outside. And as a result of which, you see certain belts of the country are experiencing this phenomenon of farmer suicide, where farmers are indebted and they are unable to, because the cost of farming is so high, they are unable to recover that cost, the returns are poor. So as a result of which, they are not able to pay off their debts and they end up committing suicide, especially because, I mean, there's so many factors, even, you know, climate change. I mean, if the monsoon fails, it's problematic in areas which are rain-fed. It's problematic because the groundwater does not get recharged. And this country is going through a major agriculture crisis at this point of time. But the service industry is completely jobless growth because it's providing jobs only to a certain section of society. Farmers and people in rural areas are not skilled for those jobs, whether they are in the information technology sector or in the communication sector.
Well, and finally, we asked Manshi about what it is like to be a woman activist in India.
Yeah, well, it's very useful to have that insight on this because actually from the outside, from here, where people talk a lot about India as a growing economy and how the, like, how India is the example to be followed by the developing countries. And of course, there are huge differences between, well, the people who are actually making money. And of course, there's a big agriculture or farming sector that is not being benefited by this whole model. Well, you mentioned a little bit about what it's like to be a woman in India, talked about, but also I would like to have like your insight of what are the challenges that you face on your everyday work as a woman activist.
I think the first thing that one sees is a certain sense of isolation because you don't have enough women activists out there. But at the same time, I would say that if you look at the women who are facing the brunt of the, you know, situation on the ground, I mean the women from the villages or the women who are affected by, let's say, many of these projects, if you look at all these movements that are coming up in different parts of the country, if you look at the Maoist rebellion that's happening, you will see women in the forefront everywhere. So in the middle class, I mean middle class activists, you'll see probably fewer women, you know, like from the class that I come from. But if you actually go to areas where, you know, people are facing the brunt of the situation, whether it's in agriculture and forest related issues, on dam related issues, when you have an agitation, you will always see a very, very large number of women. And there's a very clear reason for that, because the impacts on their lives are probably much, much more than they are on the lives of the men. For instance, just an example, like when a family loses their land, in India, most of the land belongs to the men. I mean, all the land belongs to the men. Men have titles on property. It's never joint titles between the man and the woman. So finally, the decision to give up land, even if a particular family decides that, okay, I'm going to sell my land, piece of land to this company, or I'm going to let the government acquire it, and I'm not opposing, the decision lies in the hands of the man. But the woman is the caretaker of the family. She's working on the farm. She's working in the forest. She's bringing the water. So, you know how it is. I mean, you have the same situation in you know, South Asian and Latin American countries. So it's the women who are you know, going to face increasing or are facing increasing destitution because the man walks off with the money. As a woman, I feel that, yeah, I mean, there are more and more women who are coming out, but we have a long way to go. As a woman, I'm able to mobilize more women. And, so that brings the the positive, side of it. Because if a man who's an activist goes into a village, his access to talking to women is not as much because of all the social barriers that are there.
Well, I think this last part was quite interesting about women activism and how it works in India, because I think in some points are in common with the work that we do here, for instance, with rural women, how the women feel more comfortable in an environment with other women, and they are able to talk about their own problems and how they are the ones who are the, well, actually the ones who organize everything around the house, and well, also in India, is the production and farming production is depends on women mostly.
Yes, especially in India, where property belongs to men, as she said, and women are the ones, but women are the ones who suffer the consequences of these models. So they should be the ones who, well, provide solutions and will have a say in all of these problems.
Well, very interesting insight. And now we're going to have a little break from the interview and listen to the Noisettes song called Never Forget You.
Watch you drinking rum or whiskey. Now won't you have a with me.
Okay, that was the Noisettes with Never Forget You. And our next story takes us to Brazil, where Pedro Alcantara was murdered by two men on motorcycle who haven't been identified. And this happened in Pará, which is a state where, unfortunately, this type of things happened very often. And Pedro Alcántara was a member of the Union of Family Agriculture Workers. He was a very active participant of the struggle for land reform. And, well, basically, this is why he was murdered. He was the murder took place in front of his wife. And this new crime took place hours before the after the suspension of another case, which is a symbol of the struggle, which has become a symbol of the struggle for land, which is the murder of U.S. nun Dorothy Stang. She was murdered in 2005, and well, her murder is still unpunished as the one of Pedro Alcántara.
Yeah, well, the case of Dorothy Stang is very famous. She was a nun who was working there in the area of Pará, and she was killed by gunmen in 2005. And do you know, well, I think I don't have enough information right now, but why the trial got suspended? Or
well, the trial is against
the
intellectual author of the crime.
Okay.
And he was prosecuted, I think, a few years ago, but then he was fined that he was not guilty, and now the trial is scheduled for next week, I think.
Okay, so we'll follow up on what happens with that. But, of course, I mean, the case of Dorothy Stang became very famous because she was a U.S. nun. So, as you were telling me off the record, there are so many stories that you can find about this crime in U.S. media, but not so much about what is happening with other people, the same kind of crimes, mm-hmm. murders taking place in that state and for the same reasons in Brazilian media or in Latin American media. Mm-hmm. So I think it's important that people remember what happened to her because it's something that it raised awareness about the whole situation in Brazil. But at the same time, it's important that we continue reporting about, well, this is still happening. There's other people in this situation. And in the case of Dorothy Stang, there's a trial going on. But I don't know what's going to happen with this case, for instance.
Yes, the thing is that these murders are not considered political or problems or murders related to the land reform or to the land struggles. They are considered just common crimes, and so the proper investigations are not being carried out.
Yeah, that's right. It's something that, well, we will follow up on this. And our next story is, well, a happier one, because there was elections in Bolivia last week, and the movement towards socialism, that's the ruling party of Evo Morales, won in 6 of the 9 local governments. And well, there were elections of mayors and members of parliament in this time on Sunday. And well, Evo Morales said he was positive that these results ratify the democratic and participatory Bolivia that is undergoing this process of structural reforms. And well, he also mentioned something about working with the opposition. And well, actually, he said he called the opposition to join the process of change and to leave the confrontation aside. Because, as you know, Bolivia is sort of divided in two areas, and one is the what they call the half-moon departments, which are the departments that want to the autonomy. Well, some people in those departments want to have autonomy from the rest of Bolivia, and usually in those departments is where Evo Morales has most of the opposition. But in this case, Pando was one of the... used to be one of the bastions of the opposition, voted for the MAS. So they voted for the ruling party this time. So in total, it was La Paz, Oruro, Potosí, Cochabamba, Chuquisaca, and Pando, the states or, well, the departments that voted for the ruling party, while Santa Cruz and Beni and Tarija voted for the opposition, which was quite expected, actually. But I think the ruling party won more departments than they were expecting. So it was a victory for Evo Morales and the movement towards socialism. Okay, so now we're going to our second song of the of today's show. It's by Danger Mouse and Sparkle Horse. It's called Every Time I'm With You.
Voices, Real World Radio's live show.
So that was Danger Mouse and Sparkle Horse. And, well, our next story is about Haiti, about a brigade of members from Brazil that is going in a solidarity mission, in Haiti. They actually arrived earlier this week. And, well, the story is based on an interview that I had the chance to do with one of the members of the brigade, who is a journalist, Thales Gomez. And well, he was at the Escola Florestan Fernandez, that's the school of the movement of the Rural Landless Workers Movement, the MST in Brazil. And well, he explains in the interview, he explains a little bit what the mission is about. And unfortunately, the audio is only available in Portuguese. But, well, the important thing is there's a team of 30 representatives of social movements, including La Via Campesina, that will be in Haiti for a year to work there to improve the water supply, to provide technical advice in agroecology and reforestation programs. This is the second brigade that the social movements are sending. The first one arrived recently. But of course, the situation of this second brigade is a bit different considering the earthquake that happened in January in that country and that, well, basically devastated the capital city. So they had to speed up the whole process of going and change a little bit their plans to work there. And they are going to work a lot on agroecology because one of the problems that Haiti has is, well, after the earthquake, a lot of people migrated to the rural areas, considering, well, the devastation that was in the city. And they don't have agriculture. They don't have enough for their own consumption. And, for instance, the energy is based on charcoal, and they have deforest more every year than the amount of forest they can plant, of trees they can plant. So it's something that's totally unsustainable. So I think it's a very good initiative because what it's trying to do is to change the development model that's in Haiti and also their production and try to make it a more autonomous country.
But yes, one of their problems is particularly this dependence on import products. For instance, in 1990 they were able to produce up to 80% of their products for the local market, but now that figure is like less than 45%. So that means that 55% of what they consume comes from other countries.
Well, it's also important to mention that Haiti has a very important history in terms of, well, they were the first black republic in the world, and that had a lot of repercussions because, well, some countries like the U.S. didn't acknowledge or didn't recognize Haiti's independence for a while because they still had slaves in their own country, and so they didn't want the same, like, a rebellion of the slaves in their own country. So it's funny that it started as an independent, one of the first independents in our continent, and then a lot of things happened. Well, France demanded the payment of a huge debt because of no longer having economic profits from the country because of, well, they don't no longer were have, they no longer had slaves, so that meant a loss, an economic loss for France. So they demanded the payment of a debt that was one of the problems for Haiti, and also the fact that the U.S. imposed the structural adjustment programs promoted by, well, the Washington Consensus that happened in other countries of the continent. But basically, they imposed certain economic policies in exchange for aid and for economic aid. So that's what led to this neoliberal and unsustainable model that they are currently having that's does not let them be actually independent. So they, well, now they are sending aid and a lot of things, but it's important to bear in mind that the very country that's now saying, okay, we have to loan, well, not loan this time, they said, actually, we are going to donate money to Haiti, that was the U.S., was the actual cause of their own economic problems.
Yes, and now after the earthquake, let's not forget the military presence that the U.S. is deploying there, which is, well, a way of continuing this link and
invasion,
not letting the country to be independent.
Because what's going on right now, it's a military occupation if you think about it. And I think it's very interesting that these social movements in Brazil are sending this brigade because actually Brazil is one of the countries that is in charge of this, the MINUSTAH, that's the United Nations Stabilization Mission in Haiti. And we also are ashamed to say that Uruguay has sent troops there. So we also have our own troops in the MINUSTAH occupying Haiti. I think, well, that's one of the problems. And another one of the problems is the debt. And there's a huge movement of organizations that are calling for the cancellation of the foreign debt. That's because that's the first step to let them have their own development and start while growing in a sustainable way.
So this is why this brigade is important, because it is giving them tools to provide for themselves and to produce their own products for their own local market.
Exactly. Well, the brigade is made up mostly by men, but there are four women also going there. And I don't know, I imagine it must be really hard work to arrive there and find the country in that situation.
They are going to be there for a year, right?
Yeah, for a year. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, well, good luck to them. And I had the chance to meet the brigade, and, well, they are all very young people, actually. Like, it's on average, it's like 30 in their 30s, but a lot in their 20s. So I think it's going to be a great experience for them, but also, well, they are going to be very helpful for the Haitian people. Okay, and our last story is about climate change, and the theme that we are going to be following more this month. Mercedes is going to be introducing it.
Yes, this is the climate conference that is going to take place in Cochabamba, in Bolivia, in April the 19th to the 22nd. This is called the World People's Conference on Climate Change and the Rights of Mother Earth. And this conference was promoted by Bolivian President Evo Morales. And Friends of the Earth International, for instance, is going to have a big delegation there. There are going to be several working groups, which will produce proposals on several issues like the Kyoto Protocol or the carbon market, climate debt, agriculture, food sovereignty. So it's going to be a very fruitful process there. And also, Evo Morales proposed back in December, when he was at the climate conference, the COP15 in Copenhagen, he proposed to have a referendum on climate change, to ask the people of the world population, what they thought about different aspects, because he said that, well, it's the people who has to say what they think, and the leaders of the world should do what the people says. So the proposal is to ask the population of the world what they think of, if they agree with changing this consumption model, the current consumption model, if they agree that developed countries should reduce their emissions, and so as to not to limit the increase of world temperature to 1 degree Celsius, and also to have a climate change budget larger than the defense budget that most countries are spending. And what also to create a climate justice tribunal to try those who are responsible for climate change, and also restoring harmony with nature.
Yeah, it's very interesting, this last issue about the climate justice tribunal. There was a meeting last year, I think it was in October, that it was, well, when this issue first came up. And well, we already have this People's Tribunal that is going to session in Madrid, that is against transnational corporations. So I think it's a good idea to have the same thing, but for climate crimes in this case. And well, it's important to have a good idea of what this referendum is about, because a lot of people are talking about it, but like, really, there's not so much information about it yet. I think the conference is going to be very important, first of all, because it's the first time, I think, or I don't know, it doesn't happen very often that a president or a government is calling a conference with heads of state, but also with the social movements. They want to hear what the social movements have to say. And I think that in the case of Bolivia, there is a lot of agreement in several issues, for instance, with the positions of Friends of the Earth, mm-hmm. so and other organizations are working for climate justice. So it's going to be interesting to see, well, different discussions that take place there and what the outcomes will be, especially considering that we have Mexico very soon. Like, the next COP16 is going to take place in Cancun, and I think it's going to be tougher than Copenhagen, at least that's what most people are saying. So it's a good way to be for the social movements and for the people who well, are not part of the umbrella and of the developed countries, to have a very strong position to go to Mexico and to demand what we want from this process. Also, I think it's interesting that it's a parallel thing to the UN process, mm-hmm. and it seems more inclusive as well.
Yes, exactly. It provides a space for social movements to talk to the to the government authorities and together create the solutions that affect us all.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think that's all for today. We're going to have a lot more about this conference in Cochabamba in the next weeks and also during the whole conference, of course, because, well, it starts now, like on the 19th of April, so very soon. So we hope to have a lot of interviews with the activists and the people affected as well. So we're going to say goodbye until next week, and we are going to listen to our last song of today's show. That's Mashaboom by Feist. So see you next week.
See you next week. Bye.
Helping the kids out of their coats, the way the babies haven't been born. Unpacking the bags and setting up, and planting lilacs and buttercups. But in the meantime, I got it hard. Second floor living without a yard. It may be years until the day my dreams will match up with my pay. Talk to the neighbors and tip my cap on little Rod Belly. Oh.